Facebook is rapidly becoming one of the world's most powerful companies. On today's second backstory, we will take a look at the inner workings of the social networking giant with Jesse Hempel and Miguel Helft, senior writers for Fortune magazine. Their article, Inside Facebook, is in the current issue of the magazine, and I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Facebook has a much closer relationship with its users than most other companies. Or should I call them customers?
Users would be probably the better term, since they're not necessarily buying anything in order to be on Facebook, right?
But does that close relationship complicate the provider-user equation in a way that we can't call it business relationships. I don't know what kind of relationship it is, but it's still a company and a non-member of the company. It gets rather complicated, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. The real customers of Facebook, in a way, are the advertisers. But the users are certainly in a relationship with the company, and it's similar to a lot of social media companies where, you know, we, the users, get a service for free, and they get to monetize that.
Nearly one in every eight people on the planet uses Facebook. Has that kind of rapid expansion of the company created difficulties for it?
It's created all kinds of challenges. First of all, I mean, if you stop and just think about how old this company is, this company has been around for 8 years, and it has gone from being a couple of kids in a dorm room to being 3,200 employees at last count. That poses all kinds of challenges, both for the company and for us, the users, as the service grows.
Does it still have opportunities for growth with the other 7 out of 8 people on the planet who don't use it?
I guess that's one way to think of it. Only 1 out of 8 people are using it now. There's so much opportunity right there, right?
What about Twitter and Google Plus? Are they actually competitive with Facebook?
Well, Twitter is somewhat competitive, though its uses are a little bit different in that Facebook, you really are hanging out with your friends, and Twitter has evolved into more of a broadcasting message where you broadcast to a large group of followers.
And many people do both.
Of course, and many people do both and do the same thing on both in that they post, they cross-post their updates. Google Plus is more directly attempting to compete with Facebook, and it's very hard to know at this point how far it has gone and succeeded. Google's trumpeting some big numbers of users, but it's not clear how many of those users actually how frequently they use the service.
You describe Facebook as having two symbiotic halves. What are they, and are they in? Is there tension between the two?
Well, let's start with what they are. There's, first of all, the people who are making the product, the engineers and the designers, who are thinking a lot about what we, the users, see. And then the other side of the company would be the business side, and that would be everyone from the sales team who's out selling the advertisers on the product to the lawyers who are protecting it as it grows when it comes to issues like privacy. And you have to keep in mind that every company has these two sides. Every internet company, certainly every advertising business, has these two sides. And there's an inherent tension in a healthy business between these two sides. And sure, we saw that at Facebook as well.
Well, I'm assuming that Facebook's founder, Mark Zuckerberg, is more comfortable with the first of those two halves, or
that's
am
right.
I wrong?
No, that's right. I mean, both, obviously, he oversees the entire company since he's the CEO, but he's directly involved in the product and engineering side, and that's what he spends most of his time in. And to some extent, his decisions are always product-first decisions, and that's as somebody said to us, it's part of the... It causes a whiplash for the folks on the ad side where, the product folks might decide to change something that has negative effects on the advertising. But it's also part of the genius. It's the reason why the the social network has been so successful and attracted, you know, 800 million people.
You note that the word hack is plastered all over the Facebook offices. Does it mean something different to them than the word hack means to me and most of the people I know?
Well, Leonard, what does it mean to you?
Well, it means people who can hack into other people's computers. And I'm hoping somebody doesn't hack into mine.
I think that the word hack has over time sort of taken a little bit of a negative meaning that the folks at Facebook would, loudly decry. And Mark very explicitly spelled this out in his investor letter when the company filed a couple of weeks ago for their initial public offering. Facebook sees the whole terminology around hack as simply embracing this idea of moving fast to solve problems at whatever cost. And, in fact, Facebook believes that hacking is a really good thing. It's what keeps folks innovative.
It keeps them on their toes?
Sure. And you know, to complete that thought, too, the word hacking has become known in popular culture as people breaking into networks. But originally in computer science, it was used to mean people, you know, creating code and trying things out and trying them again and again. And that's very much the ethos that Facebook operates by. It creates products that are sometimes unfinished, and then it sees how people use them and tweaks them until they're just right.
Well, Shannon, one of our listeners on the Upper East Side, has written in to ask, what about AOL and MySpace? Both of those companies had rapid rises and falls. Does Facebook have strategies for avoiding a similar situation for it?
Well, it's funny that you mention AOL because our story opens with an all-hands meeting that Mark Zuckerberg had at his headquarters in Menlo Park, and he says, let's be mindful of history. Look at companies like AOL. They once dominated and seemed unassailable, and they lost their edge. And Facebook's very aware of that history. And, you know, AOL, MySpace, there's a long list of others. And it's working very hard. And in the last few years, it's been thinking about the day when it goes public as a moment where this hacker culture could be under threat. And it's worked very hard to institutionalize that culture to keep that dynamic, that fast-moving spirit, essentially the inner startup.
Now let's talk about going public. They recently filed for an initial public offering. Do they need any more money than they already have?
Well, going public, of course, is about a lot more than money.
It is?
Well, I guess it's about who receives that money, too, to some degree. But going public is going to allow this company to grow at a level and a pace that we haven't seen yet. And this company waited a very long time, longer than this type of company might have a decade ago for this event. And it will be the big seminal change in this company's history. I think it'll allow this company to, first of all, capture the remaining 7 of 8 users around the world, but also to find new ways to allow advertisers to interact with customers and to really, grow to the next level as a company.
Well, do they have any competition out there? The big people in the field are Apple and Amazon, but they have very different kinds of services.
Well, going back to your previous question, Google Plus, so far has not been successful, but the folks at Facebook are very mindful that Google is a giant, has tremendous resources, and could certainly mount a very serious challenge.
Well, you say in the article that the IPO will also cement Zuckerberg's status as an iconic Silicon Valley entrepreneur. The IPO filing was recently amended to note that it will be a controlled company. What does that mean?
Well, Facebook has set up a dual stock structure, which is something that, back in the old days, some newspaper companies and a handful of others, like the New York Times Company had, and where a small number of shareholders control the company. And this notion has been revived in Silicon Valley, first with Google, and now the trend seems to have picked up. Zynga, Groupon, and now Facebook are founder control companies, and to a larger, smaller, larger extent. And you know, for an investor, it's a question they have to decide: do they want to be shareholders in a company that is fully controlled by the CEO, where essentially he controls the board? He, you know, anything he wants to do, he will do, and nobody else can really have a say.
You describe Facebook as a company that has designed a set of rules for how to cultivate its own brand of chaos. You mentioned there has a 3,500 people working there. That could be quite chaotic. Is that what you're talking about?
I think maybe one of the best ways to think about those rules is to think about what Facebook is going for with its hacker culture. It goes back to that word we were talking about.
And you say Facebook, they're sent to boot camps where they learn to think like Zuckerberg.
boot camp is part of that. Facebook is looking for ways to train a group of folks who, you know, there are these folks by and large who come to work, particularly as engineers at the company. Often this is their first job. They're not managers by nature, and they've had no training in it. Boot camp is a program that helps to sort of set in place the beginnings of management structure and training, and a way to think about helping Facebook to maintain this hacker culture.
Go ahead.
Well, you know, another example of one of those rules is this thing that they do called Hack-a-Month, which is, on the engineering and product side at least, every 12 to 18 months, every engineer is encouraged to leave whatever he or she is doing and try doing something entirely different for a month. And, you know, if this weren't enforced as a rule, if it weren't a cultural expectation, people would probably be afraid to do it, because it means doing something you've never done before. You might not be very good at it. But because it's enforced as a rule, it causes people to absolutely have to try new things. And the result is that maybe a third of the time, people move over and actually do something entirely new.
Now, Sheryl Sandberg, who's a former Google executive, has a very prominent role in the company. Why was she brought on board? She seems to be very different than Zuckerberg, at least the Zuckerberg that I met in the movie The Social Network.
Well, she was brought on board because Facebook needed to build up its business side. For the first few years of the company, Mark tried to run that side with a number of deputies, and several of them left, were pushed out, fired. They went through two CFOs, one president, one COO, and a bunch of other senior execs. And when Sheryl Sandberg came on board, she brought a tremendous amount of stability, professionalism. She went a long ways towards really integrating the business side of the company, which, as we say in the story, runs somewhat differently, but it's well integrated into the company.
My thanks to both of you for being on our show, Miguel Helft and Jesse Hempel, senior writers for Fortune magazine. They wrote the cover story called Inside Facebook for the current issue of that magazine. And we've been talking about Facebook as on our second backstory segment today. Thanks again.
Thanks for having us.